Okay, today is January 21st. My name is Carson Savoy, and I'm here with...
Jordan Richardson.
Okay, so I have a couple open questions for you today. Cool. First off, how do you identify and what are your pronouns?
Male, he, him mm-hmm. pronoun, okay. And gay.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, can I ask, what is your occupation?
I'm a teacher.
Okay.
Yes, 7th and 8th grade social studies. I have also worked as an archivist and a collections manager at a museum and at a research center and here at the Ernest J. Gaines Center.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Well, do you feel that choosing these variety of occupations, have they had anything to do with being a part of the LGBTQ plus community?
I didn't at first, but now maybe, just in the approaches that I use for teaching and in looking at history, it's all very bottom-up histories. So it's telling the stories of people whose voices were left out, and overlooked and not worthy of being a top-down or a popular history. So yeah, actually.
When did you discover that you were part of the LGBTQ plus?
I always felt that I was a little different. I didn't know it was gay per se until maybe 5th or 6th grade, when the internet was a thing in the house, and the AOL chat rooms. The AOL chat rooms were on the computer, and I was like, this gay section, okay, this is interesting. And then it led to, like, porn. So then, I would say maybe around 12 years old. 12.
Have you always lived in Louisiana?
I have. I'm from Morgan City, Louisiana, which is about an hour and some change away. It's very similar to Lafayette. Lafayette's a little bigger with a bigger city component, but Morgan City's very similar to the small towns outside of Lafayette, like New Iberia and Crowley and all those areas. Yeah.
Can you describe to me your upbringing?
I grew up with a lot of my extended family around me. With in the house, my mom, my grandpa, my grandmother, and one uncle. We all lived together, and then my aunt lived a little further down the street, and in the area we lived was a bunch of extended families. So my grandpa's brothers, sisters, and their kids and their families. So it was a very, like, family populated area. I would say we were pretty decently middle class. I went to public school. It was a fairly good upbringing. My grandpa, grandmother, and the people their age, though, are your African Americans who grew up in the 60s, the 40s to the 60s, so boomers into the 60s. So they were not the most accepting of gays. And I knew it was something, especially once I figured out what gay was and that I probably was that, that I could not really express or act on or claim to be, just because I had heard comments that they said. So from an early point on, I was trying to rectify who I was with this idea of who the older people around me thought or projected who I was probably going to be. So yeah.
We have a section called Digging Deeper Questions. If there's anything you're not comfortable answering, of course, just let me know. We'll move past it. This kind of has an overlap with the previous things we've talked about, but could you describe what it's like growing up gay in Louisiana?
It's not for the faint of heart. it's tough. I feel like growing up gay in Louisiana is this weird juxtaposition, because this state is a juxtaposition in itself. It's very liberal in its culture, but it's super conservative in who gets to enforce it, who gets the resources to be able to celebrate things, and who gets to be the face of things. Growing up here, you have to hide it. You have to hide being gay for the most part if your family is not accepting. Which is conflicting, which, I mean, obviously, and this is probably the lay of the land everywhere, that this is, that people who have to hide being gay is, but, like, it confuses you. So by the time that you come out, you have to kind of relearn who you are, essentially, because you've spent so many years, sometimes decades or more, hiding who you are, so your hidden persona is who you are until you come out, and then you have to relearn who you are in a matter of 4 to 5 years, per se, which is terrible compared to the cis and hetero people who are allowed to grow up and express who they are and be sexual and make mistakes and grow at a natural pace. I feel like in Louisiana and other southern states like it, there's an unnaturalness in our growth. Yeah.
How do you think being gay has affected your development as a person?
I think being gay has affected my development in probably a really positive way. I think that part of the reason why I have been always so open and accepting and understanding is because I know what it's like to not have those things extended to me. And I've never wanted someone else to feel that way. And I think that that also overlaps with being black as well. In the spaces that I've grown up, education-wise, I was always a minority. In some of the sports and clubs that I played, I was a minority. So I know what it's like to be pushed to the edge, are not seen or are used for specific reasons. And so I think being gay has, like, made me super open-minded to a lot. Yeah, I'll leave it at that. It's definitely made me a better person.
How would you describe your experiences as an adolescent?
Like experiences as a gay person or a queer person? Or just adolescence in general?
You can answer both, or just an individual,
Okay. I think even with having to hide who I was, adolescence wasn't terrible. I got along with most people, even the assholes. So I never felt threatened per se. I knew that I absolutely could not come out of the closet. I knew that even though some people suspected it, that they probably talked about it or raised the concerns or the questions, that me not confirming it was a shield. It was that maybe he's not, that was my protection. And I think that helped me progress through adolescence as unscathed as you can be. But I think where I took my bumps and bruises were because there was no confirmation and because people only guessed at my sexuality, the things that they said. And people say a lot of things when they think no one's at home. So there was a lot that I took mentally from people that I trusted and people that I loved and people that I considered friends, and hearing them say certain things about gay people in queer life, that was hurtful. And that was probably the roughest part of adolescence, was trying to make sense of an already confusing time for everyone, but also silently fighting against these stereotypical ideas that they had already made about people like me.
Can you describe your experiences at school?
Yeah. School was actually one of my saving graces. I've always had a knack for education, learning, and I used my education and I used the clubs and things that I participated in as a way to get out of my very small family-based community, who also were just as homophobic and intolerant as the kids at school. But at least with the kids at school, like I said, I could be a kid, I can participate in things, I could be around people who kind of understood me much better. School was definitely my saving grace, because it then allowed me to participate in things that took me away from the small town of Morgan City, and get to see that there was life out there, but also secretly get to see that there were people like me who were out there. Yeah.
What community groups were you involved with during this period, and what role did they play in growing up?
I did a lot of work with National Honor Society, Beta, Student Council, those types of things, where you foster leadership. In high school, you don't really get any of the things that you promised done. So it was just leading me on to be able to do those things at a collegiate level, which I did do. And I was also pretty active in church growing up. Church was the first place where I started to notice that I had a knack for speaking and in engaging in crowds and being able to stand there and present and do things like that. I feel like that point in time, those groups prepared me to do the things that I'm doing now. And to be confident about the things that I'm doing now, even though there was a lot of uncertainty back in those times.
So you mentioned the church. So was that a big part of your life?
For the first 10 to 12 years, I would say yes. My grandpa was very active in the church, and he was very active in our small community, so a lot of people knew him. And so we were churchies, and we were there most Sundays for long hours. And when he died in 2001, my family started to go to church less, but they were still very, very religious. And so I'm still somewhat religious. I still believe in Christianity, though not the church specifically in itself. But it was a huge part of my life for sure the first 13, 14 years. It kind of fizzled out. The church did, but spirituality is still with me, per se.
What role would you say that plays in your life today?
I would say that being spiritual today helps me make sense of the stuff I know I cannot make sense of. I don't believe that we're here all by this gigantic coincidence, and things are the way that they are by spontaneity. Being spiritual, and I hate to put it this way, but I the things that I know that I cannot make sense of, I just kind of put it in a spirituality box and just mark it off as I'm not meant to understand this. It is the way that it is. I can try. If I can't change it, then here we go.
Can you tell me about any difficulties or hardships that you faced as a gay man?
Yes. let's see. Is there like categories that we can break this down into, like coming out or like in certain locations?
Yeah, here, you live in Lafayette?
Yes.
So, I suppose this question could be directed into, like, I would say the past, you know, your time living here in Lafayette, mm-hmm. and past, you know, say, however long you've lived here.
Okay. So I moved to Lafayette in 2017, January 2017, so it's almost an anniversary. I moved here for graduate school. I knew no one. Even though Morgan City is just down the road, I did not spend a bunch of time in Lafayette. I went to undergrad at LSU, and I came out while I was at LSU. So it was slightly different. By the time I got here, I was a little more self-assured as a gay man. I was pretty excited to move to this area because I had heard good things about gay life here, or at least not bad things. But I would honestly say that my experience as a gay man here overlaps with my experience probably as a gay black man here, and it has not been the best. When I did move here, I was using Grindr because, duh. And so I had started to talk to someone who was a little older, and we like kind of hit it off. It was more of a friendship. And so he was probably the only person that I kind of knew well coming here. And when I got here, this man did everything in his power to avoid me. So, like, heavily ghosted. And, like, I want to say it was maybe a month and a half before I, like, had the balls to go out, because I was here for school, and school was busy, and then I went out with my cohort one night. We went to a bar. He was there. He recognized me, and he just looked, and kind of nodded and went on about his business. And so I just pretended that I was fine, because I was with my friends, so like, and I didn't want them to know, you know. But then I leave, and a few hours later, I get texts on the phone. Hey, you know, you looked great tonight. It was good to finally meet you. And me, being very direct, respond with, I can't classify that as actually meeting you. We said nothing. and he spurts off some sassy comments as well, and I'm also just like, okay. And so there was, the early days of me living here, there was a lot of app communication. And also, I'm 27, 28 at the time, sexual. So I'm using the apps like everyone else. And there was a lot of people who I had the same kind of interactions with. I would see them out. They wouldn't really say much, but then later they would say, oh, I want to have these full conversations, like on the apps, or ask for pictures and things that were, I wasn't comfortable always sending. Sometimes I was, sometimes I wasn't. And to me, being new in this space, I kind of felt like a little pressure to maybe give them what they needed and hope, oh, okay, they would like me or I would be better accepted. And that was not the case. And so I found more community with my cohort in graduate school than the gay community here, per se. It wasn't the best. And it's still, I mean, sadly, it's still kind of that way. The reason why I also said that my experiences kind of like overlap with me being probably an African-American man is because there have been times like I have watched people come into this community at the same time or after me. And do you remember, I don't know if you would remember these, the store Abercrombie and Fitch. Mm. There would be people who looked like those models who came into this area, and I would see that they would get accepted much quicker. And it was a very cis, hetero, white, bodybuilder type look that got you accepted. And I'm very perceptive and I'm very observant, and I would notice that if it was a black person, they were usually much lighter skinned, almost bodybuilder like, to be accepted in this community immediately. And so also on the apps and stuff like that, sometimes I would purposely not put a face picture. And it was there that I really feel comfortable in making that assertion, because I sometimes would talk with people for almost like 2, sometimes going on 3 weeks. And if you're talking to someone for that long, then you have somewhat of an interest in them. Whether you're claiming it to be for friendship or for whatever type of relations. I would then eventually work up the nerve to send a picture of myself. And I know I'm not Prince Charming, but I also know I'm not but as ugly. And immediately, the tones and the shifts in conversation would become less conversational. They would be simply just asking or replying to questions that I send, because I would pick up on the change. Or sometimes they would just completely block. And it was those moments where they would completely block that were the most scary to me, because it was like I just spent 2 to 3 weeks talking to this person who I thought at least we could be friends. And they could be anyone. I go to a lot of establishments and have coffee and get things done, and it could be anyone. And I, for a while, it sometimes made me nervous to even go out, because it was, I didn't know who I was talking to. I didn't know, you know, were they talking about me to everyone else, or, you know, just kind of nervous to really. It was a transition from me coming here and being super excited to be here and try to venture out into a community, and then it fizzled into me just coexisting, knowing that that community's here, but really it's far away. It's something that's not accessible to me.
There's a lot. Like, you said a lot of things that generated a lot of further questions that I have. That's okay.
Yeah, that's fine.
First off, you mentioned going to LSU, being in Baton Rouge.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about, is there a noticeable difference between the Baton Rouge queer community and the Lafayette?
I would say it's similar. There, I didn't notice the things that I noticed here, because I think that I was too young to be as perceptive as I was. When I moved here, I was 21 when I came out. And I came out my sophomore year of college. So when I did come out, it was like, I'm out. Trying to have as much sex as possible. Like, I'm out. I'm in this new space. So I was interacting more with people my own age versus the community at large. Today, I would say that the difference in the Baton Rouge community is, it's very similar. There's a lot more lawyers there. I do feel like there's an attitude also of exclusion there as well, but I do not live there per se, so I don't feel the need to interact or completely submerge myself in Baton Rouge's community the way that I wanted to here, because I wanted to be part of the community when I moved here, so I don't really have like an exact compare and contrast.
You've talked a lot about how, you know, not only being within the queer community but also being Black has created a lot of difficulty both inner community and intra community. Do you think that there's a lack of support within the LGBTQ+ community regarding race, class, etc.?
Yes. I just, because we are a microcosm of the world itself, and often group of people who are looked at as other in a negative, in a more negative than positive way, we create distinctions within our communities that are even more harder to live up to, or to achieve, or to cope with. I think, and I've observed that sometimes whiteness completely overpowers being gay for some gay males, who can probably pass as heterosexual or not feminine or not gay, and whiteness as an agent to blend into society allows you to get resources that you need for coping with anxiety and stress and all of the bullshit everyone has to deal with anyways. And as a person of color, a person of color coming from a small town, more rural than city, religious, anxiety and mental health, God is the answer for all of that. There's no scientific answer. So when you come to these spaces and you're exposed to people who are like, no, there can be a chemical imbalance as well. They know how to treat that. They don't know how to treat racism. They don't know that they can be perpetrators of being racist or being discriminatory. And that is not easy to have a conversation about. That's not easy to accept if you are those things, because you don't think that you're being that way. But you are sometimes reinforcing those ideas, those tropes, and certainly allowing it to fester. And I think that being an African American gay person in spaces that are heavily dominated by white people is interesting as well, because it's not real. I can look at actions and see how people kind of go about the way they think or what they can reinforce. It's difficult. Sometimes during work, sometimes during groups or things that I've been on, leaving the house as either a gay or a black man is already preparing for this 8, sometimes 10 to 12 hour game of chess of whose presence am I going to disturb by being there today? Am I safe? Can I be me? Is being me going to cost me my position? And it's heavy. But I think going back to one of the good things about being gay in me being accepting and open, is that it hasn't completely soured me on people, even though I have every right to be. It hasn't completely soured me on people as a whole.
Building on this, what can you share about your experience with queer spaces in Lafayette?
I haven't because of some of the earlier experiences I've had in this area, I haven't gone to a lot of gay-friendly events. Because it got to a point where I just chose that I wasn't going to put myself out there if I wasn't welcome in those spaces. Pride was something that I was going to have that was going to be completely personal to me and not something that I was going to share in a physical space. I've gone out to some bars a few times, and had not bad experiences. I've known one or two, maybe at most five people at a time in those spaces, so I was able to just kind of stay with them and have fun. I would say that my best experiences probably in queer spaces in Lafayette is probably at Beausoleil Books, just because I like to read and I like a good drink. and it has both. That's been a great place for me within the past few years, the time that it's been here. That's been fun. Yeah.
What do you like to read?
I like to read historical nonfiction, but also fiction. And randomly science. Like I was not a science person growing up, but like now, for some reason, my brain has been like, you actually understand this and you like it. So like every once in a while, like a nice little Nat Geo magazine or body processes books that I now also somehow completely understand. But mostly historical nonfiction topics, in just fiction as an escape.
Mm-hmm. Are there any authors that you have particular interest in, or is it more so genre-based?
It's more so genre-based, but I do like... let me see, because it's on there. Jodi Picoult. Mm-hmm. As well as Layla Abram. I've read three or four books by Layla Abram now, and each one is like the best one. So I would say that she's on my list now. And Jodi Picoult, but it's more genre based. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Somebody who's also really interested in reading historical nonfiction, can I ask, like, is there a specific geographic location or era that you are interested in?
Yeah, so I studied specifically Antebellum South. So the years right before the Civil War up until Reconstruction is my mainstay. So a lot of books about, like, Southern Dixie by Karen Cox I've read. Crescent City Girls by Lakeisha Simmons, about black girls growing up in segregated spaces in New Orleans. Ibram Kendi. What else? Stamped from the Beginning is really good. That's an amazing one. 1619 Project, which overlaps or goes past Antebellum to Reconstruction, but it's amazing. It's phenomenal.
What support have you seen from schools and other educational institutions?
This is a big jump of support. I, as an undergraduate student, I started at LSU not out. So I was not seeking, and I was not seeking to be out as well. So I did not seek out gay-friendly spaces. When I came to graduate school here, a lot of my friends in the cohort were queer, or very opening. So they were my support as well. I have since just kind of like not gotten like official support or sought out anything like that, but aligned myself with people who I trust to be my support.
So a lot of the times it's more so folks than it is like a program or something.
Yes, yeah. Which also part of the reason for that is that it's hard to find some of the programs, or like I know of Acadiana Cares and that's pretty much it, but like other than that, like it's kind of hard to find. Yeah.
For sure, like a lack of visibility.
Yeah. And that could totally be me. I'm aware of not being completely immersed in queer spaces where these talks are probably happening. But I mean, I'm not going to go there seeking support if I already feel like I'm not supported. So I'm not going to go into those spaces and start a conversation, hey, do you know any support groups? Or like, I feel like that would be a tough situation to have or to initiate. I'm probably way overthinking it, but I feel like it just would. Just working up the nerve to do that would be tough as I turn into an introvert in my older age of 32.
Do you think if there was an increase in visibility where it's like you don't have to go to these spaces, but rather like these spaces in some way, shape, or form can come to you, do you think that the appeal would be stronger?
Yeah. I mean, I would call in an instant, or like video chat, or even go to spots of support if it was like, let's grab coffee to do it, because I'm already there anyways. So I think that that would work. That would be like a solution.
Mm-hmm. So when you came out, it's been in the past, yeah, I think you mentioned you were 21?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so within the past decade.
Yeah.
Do you see a difference in the way that LGBTQ individuals in Louisiana live now versus whenever you came out?
Yeah. When I came out, it was very dramatic. It was during Mardi Gras. I was with a bunch of friends who are still my close friends to this day, heteros. And we were in New Orleans, and we were on Bourbon, and I was like visibly looking at St. Anne's streets and literally looking at gay life and like being like, I want to go there so bad. But it was like a barrier of, if I cross over into this street, then everyone I'm with will 100% know that I'm gay. And I went home, or not home, because I was staying in New Orleans at a friend's, and it was the cough syrup episode of Glee. Where the guy, the bully, like, commits suicide because he was gay and he could not tell anyone. And at that point, I was just like, I've got to say something to someone. And so I start texting people, hey, I'm gay. And it, just pushing it out slowly. And during the time, Obama hadn't legalized gay marriage yet. So I was slowly making my way out into Baton Rouge's gay community, and I could see that there were some people in the community who were partners, and I could tell long term, but not official or not visible. But within the past decade, like it's visible. And I'm glad that it's visible. I did not see that growing up. And I think that that also hampered my growth as a gay man when I came out. Because I thought the only way to express it was to be sexually active. And that was it. And, you know, when Obama does legalize gay marriage, I remember thinking, marriage is an option. And then I was like, because by that point in time, some of my friends from college and high school had already gotten married or were are engaged. I never thought that was an option for me. Growing up the way that I did, but also not seeing it visibly, I just thought the only hurdle was going to be saying I'm gay, and I had already defeated that hurdle. But then when marriage became a thing, and I was getting older, and I was no longer feeling as comfortable being super sexual all the time and craving relationships, then I started to think along the lines of, okay, it would be nice to have a husband. It would be nice to settle down with someone. And I think that that process is something that I brought with me coming to Lafayette, was the knowledge in knowing, oh, this is a space where I don't have to be just seeking sexual acts. This is a place where I could possibly find someone to be in my life long term.
What was the process of coming out like for you? I mean, you know, was there pushback?
At the time, it was scary. But what ended up happening was people who I came out to either had suspected or they thought I was asexual. So they were supportive. Or I would say the friends that I came out to first, because I came out to friends before I came out to family, they were very supportive. I want to say I maybe came out to about 7 or 8 people, like taking the time to be like, hey, let's meet up, I have something to say. And then after like that 8th time, when the last person, my friend Victoria, wasn't surprised or moved at all and just like kept it moving. I think she started talking about socks after. She's like, okay, cool. And I came out again to her for shock factor. I wanted her to be shocked. So we had to recreate this. And so after that, I was just kind of like, you know what, this is actually bullshit. I was like, this is, like, I feel as normal as everyone else, if not more normal than some of the people that I know, especially within my family. And they don't have to take the time to be nervous or to psych themselves out and to prepare people to announce who they are going to sleep with or who they love for the rest of their lives. So I just kind of decided, if people ask, I'll be honest about it, but I'm not going to make a big deal about coming out. After that 7th or 8th time of doing it, it just became aggravating. But there was one guy who is one of my best friends. I had met him the August before coming out, and I came out in like it was February, so I met him in August, the beginning of that school year. And I didn't think we would be close friends. Like, we were friends only through like a mutual guy that we knew. This guy would always like leave and go home, and so we would be forced to interact. And so we ended up becoming better friends than the guy who even introduced us. But during this time that I'm getting to know him and we're becoming super like best friends, and he's heterosexual, I was like, fuck, I am working up the nerve to come out. I don't want him to think that I am only coming out to maybe approach him in a way that's inappropriate, or so on and so forth. And I was just like, of course this would happen. This is terrible. So I think he was the hardest one to come out to, because we had become brothers at that point in time. So when I called him up in the student union, very dramatically, and he sat down and was like, "What's up?" And I couldn't say the words, so I texted it to him. And he gets up and he hugs me and he's just like, "You want to go get ice cream?" And then we go get ice cream. But then it became like super easy after. I told family-wise, I told my cousin, who's like my sister, who then tells most everyone else. And I told my uncle, who I'm really close to, because we're like brothers. He's closer to us in age than he was my mom. And so after those two, like, it really became non-essential information.
Okay, you mentioned the Glee episode. How do you feel, or do you think representation in media is important for a young LGBTQ plus person?
Absolutely. Being a kid and not seeing yourself reflected is hard. And I think now, being an adult and going back and like looking at some of those old TV shows and now recognizing some of those people were very queer in some of those shows, is like a good thing, but also hard because it was hidden. Like, you can tell they had to kind of mask or fem themselves up to get those roles. I always like had an affinity with the first Blue Power Ranger, Billy, David Yost. And to find out years later that he was queer was amazing, because I was just like, I had always kind of like identified with this man, and he was my favorite one. But now, though, to have characters and storylines that specifically center in on coming out and gender expression and identity, is so important. And I think it's very, refreshing and gives me hope of the times that we're in. Some of the kids that I teach, they ask about pronouns, and they ask about things that I wouldn't have dared ask at that age for fear of ostracism or getting beat up or whatever. So I think that because LGBTQ life is now so prevalent in media, it's allowing newer generations to express themselves earlier, which is cutting down on the amount of mental strife and having to wait until you're 21 or 22 or go halfway across the world to finally be able to be yourself.
As an educator, mm-hmm. what opportunities and challenges have you seen for LGBTQ+ educators and students?
So it's weird. Even though the media is exposing some of these kids, or most of these kids, to LGBTQ life and what it means to be different, I think that those kids living with previous generations of bigots and intolerance are still being influenced that way. There are self-proclaimed lesbians in my classes, and they are very, very open about expressing themselves and having a girlfriend and relationships, And the class as a whole seems to be more accepting of that than the guys who might identify as gay, because none of them have actually confirmed that they are or are not. And this is, I hear these things at my desk, like they just talk about these things. And then some of the expressions that these kids use towards gay men versus lesbians is still very demeaning, and it's still very derogatory, and it's very He-Man and mask bullshit. It's very, I bite my tongue all the time because it's and but it depends on the situation. If I can completely, if it's a negative situation or a negative conversation that's being had that shouldn't be talked about at all, I have the power as an educator to shut it down completely, which is what I'll do in those situations. But as an educator, most times I feel tolerated, kind of. Not that I want to be celebrated for being gay or the gay teacher. I just kind of feel like I'm here and then I'm gone.
What inspired you to pursue education?
Education itself. I love learning new things. I love having conversations about the things that I'm passionate about, with history specifically, and to have those conversations openly and candidly with small groups of students as well as big groups of students is refreshing, because they either don't get them, they haven't gotten them. Because I was a historian before I was a teacher, I've been trained to look at these subjects a different way, and to convey it a different way within the classroom. And so I like that about education. I like the merge that I can be a public historian and a teacher at once. Especially in this day and age of book banning and restrictions on education, but by large restrictions on thinking. I think that I can find crevices to bypass a curriculum that does not encourage free thinking.
As somebody, you know, as an educator who's on the forefront of, like you're saying, book banning, but also in a larger sense, you know, there's a lot of anti-LGBTQ+ legislation both nationwide and in our state. Can you talk about how that makes you feel?
God, it, like a constant battle, kind of, almost. And it's just like, it's sad, because I thought we would be past this by now. And it's now it's just another thing that I can add to a daily battle. It's just like, I shouldn't have to, that's one that I shouldn't have to be going through. It's very revealing of the legislators and the people who feel threatened as to why they feel the need to pull education at large from people who really need it. So it's not a good feeling. It's an annoyance. It's sad. It's inexcusable, and I hate that it gets support from the people who have the resources, who should be helping to educate and not dismiss it.
Talking about this, you know, some folks you know, said that it's kind of been an uptake in this type of legislation and attitude in the past, you know, decade or so. So I want to ask, how do you think we got to this point? Which is not to say that these types of behaviors haven't always been present and an issue, but in line with that method of thinking. So, recently.
I feel like as queer life has become more and more accepted and at the forefront of a lot of things, once again, the power and the resources are in the hands of a minority of people who don't wish to see it expressed so openly, whether it's because they are intolerant of it, whether it's because they secretly participate, or whatever reasoning that they have, it's just very weird to me. That it is coinciding with the world at large becoming more accepting of us, that this old guard of a few but very powerful few feel the need to really fight this, to fight education and to fight people being able to openly express love, are not even really to teach about it, but to acknowledge it, really, because that I think is more of the big struggle in education, is acknowledging that some of these people who we know were queer, because they still associate with, are these people with power still associate queer people with depraved thoughts and actions and all of these things that we know, one, to not be true, two, that heterosexuals also participate in at the same level or even worse, but also to not, for these people, these legislators, to not fight other issues like gun violence and molestation of children by priests and camp counselors with such ferocity. It's bizarre. It's beyond me.
This next question asks, what, if anything, can LGBTQ plus people do to combat this? Which I would like to expand, because it's not just the queer community which is the target of so much of this, but also not only the African American community, but in a larger diasporic sense, the Black community globally. So what do you think these folks can do to combat this?
Those groups, we need to be organized. We need to be organized. We need to be vigilant about it. But that can only, as a historian, I know for sure that can only take you so far. You need allies who are in rooms that you are not allowed to be in spaces that you are not allowed to be in, to speak up for you. You don't need allies who are going to come and meet with you and reinforce everything that you just told them. And they tell you the same thing back. That's awesome that you believe in what I just said, but telling me you believe in what I just said does not help me. I know that I'm being given the short end of the stick. You have to say those things to Billy in HR, and you have to say those things to Dolores in accounting, the people with the power who you also have an insight with, who you also can take to the side and say, well, have you ever thought about it like this? Or have you ever reconsidered this because of this? And you know, it's we need to be organized, we need to be vigilant, but we also need allies who are dependable in spaces and areas that we cannot physically be in.
What is lacking, in your opinion, at the local or statewide level in the effort to increase the visibility of our community?
Locally, I think that we are not one big community, but this several micro communities that can't get it together. At the state level, it's intolerance. Like, it's just no it's almost as if no visibility is the best thing to those people. Because if our leaders aren't acknowledging us to the constituents statewide, then we don't exist statewide. If a small group of us from Lafayette, Louisiana, managed to make it on the news to fight for whatever rights we are fighting for, then that just becomes to constituents statewide, Lafayette's problem. And so Lafayette should have to deal with that, not the state. So if they're not acknowledging us in our individual communities or statewide, then it's not a statewide problem, per se, even though we know it is. And this is a lot with not only just politicians at the state level, this is also media as well, because if media coverage of what's going, the things that we think in Lafayette need help with, if it coincides with Baton Rouge and Lake Charles and New Orleans and in Shreveport or wherever, if media is not connecting the dots for everyone outside of the state to be able to see it, then once again it's isolated to those certain areas.
My phrasing of, you know, our community and your point of, you know, it's a microcosm of multiple communities who can't get it together, you know, I think that's important, and I don't want my phrasing to try to be an erasure of that, you know. So, as a historian and an educator, do you think that there's anything we can learn from history or other countries' attitudes towards LGBTQ+ individuals?
Just that it's going to always, it's going to constantly, the fight for visibility and for rights and for just existing is going to ebb and flow. That's every minority group in history's story. It ebbs and flows with whoever's in charge, with whatever politics are in charge, with the people in certain areas, and even with different bouts of disease or whatever, it's going to be continually a fight. So I think that people need to stay in the, we can't ever get comfortable and think, oh, we've got it so good, we don't have to fight the way that our foremothers and forefathers fought in the 60s or the 70s. Like, we haven't stopped. We've not stopped. The face has changed. The fights that we're fighting has changed, but we haven't stopped. And I don't think that we, as a historian, that's guaranteed. Like, we will be unfortunately fighting these things forever and passing it on to the next generations.
I relate to that final part so much, because I think so often people will think, oh, that, you know, talking about the 60s or 70s, that's so long ago. But it's really not.
It's not.
And, you know, we're the inheritors of that legacy, you know, and so it has to continue in order to get to these next generations. So it's a good point. Okay. to switch tone for a second, because we've been, you know, talking about the very serious matter, and this is serious too, but in a different way. To you, what's the best part of being gay or a part of the larger queer community?
That I can, I mean, for the most part, I can be myself. Like, even in spaces of gay men or women who I'm not, like, the best of relations with, I can still be gay. I don't have to worry about toning anything down or worrying too much about acceptance of being gay. There's a level of freedom that I have in queer spaces, the spaces that I do go to and when I go, that I don't have to really worry about in the world at large. And even I have been more, weirdly, more accepted by white, cis, hetero men. Specifically, it's so weird. Than any other group of our demographic of people. And in that space of friends, if anyone even attempts to be derogatory toward me, there are friends who I have seen who have immediately squashed it, or who have immediately been like, oh no, nope, you can't touch him, you absolutely not, you will leave before he leaves. And I joke, but I'm also serious, that one of the best things about being gay is that I can decide to sing both the male part of a song and a female part of a song and not be questioned about it. It's just accepted.
I think we mentioned, well, earlier we were talking about queer spaces. I believe you mentioned Pride. Do you attend Pride festivities?
I've attended a few. I did attend Lafayette's, not this past year, but the year before, and had a pretty good time. I have gone to Houston's, and I did not intend to go to Atlanta's, but I was there when it happened and just got in the festivities. So I have attended Pride before, yeah.
What does Pride mean to you?
Just the ability to almost breathe. I feel like part of the, even in my explanation of how I grew up in those early questions, in those days when I was hiding who I was, that I was often, it's just, I associated with this feeling of not being able to breathe, like I was always suffocating, because I was always hiding, and I was always on guard to hide something from someone, no matter in what space I was in. I think Pride is finally being able to breathe and to relax in, if not safe spaces, tolerable spaces. That it's so much more than the parades and the events. It's being able to breathe. It's being able to express myself without concern and anxiety.
Why, to you, is Pride important in Louisiana specifically?
Pride is important in Louisiana kind of like what we talked about earlier, this state is so weird, and it's the way it functions. It's very liberal in everything it does, its celebrations, its attitude towards, everything will be fine. But that's only extended towards people who are part of that certain upper echelon in society. And it's like, no, like everyone should be able to feel like this in a state or in a place where literally the motto is that you should be able to to have a good time. Pride in Louisiana is important because I don't want anyone to experience that feeling, like I was just saying, of suffocating, of having to water yourself down so completely that you almost damn near lose yourself. And then at 18 to 20, you have to do decades of work finding yourself.
Talking about this culture in Louisiana where it's kind of like, you know, is it C'est la vie? Is that the?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know.
Laissez-faire.
Yeah, right. you know, how it's kind of, do you think it's different and distinctive from other southern states?
Yes, I do. And I think that that's why a lot of people flock to Louisiana specifically. If they are southern and don't want to go anywhere else, they go to a place where at least there's some familiarity. But you can also, you're relatively free to be who you are, especially in New Orleans and even Lafayette, like the Gulf Coast area. It seems to be somewhat of a safe haven, even within these more restrictive areas of southern states.
Do you think, and this is not on the script, of course, I'm just so interested in this point you're making, this kind of laissez-faire culture that is distinctive in Louisiana. Do you think that is retroactively, like, destructive to efforts to organize, you know, or to fight for our rights, you know, for folks who are not in this upper echelon?
Yeah, I do think it's very, it does a disservice, because sometimes in that upper echelon are some of our very own gay people who have used wealth or race or whatever advantage they have to get to where they are, but then either turned a blind eye, have the resources to move away, to ignore it, or know people in this upper echelon who will not target them directly, but will target everyone else. And I think also at the ground level, what it does is it becomes almost divisive in that if this laissez-faire attitude, someone else will take care of it, or someone else will do the heavy lifting. We don't have to do it. That it's someone else's problem. And as long as you are not directly affected, as long as you are allowed to live within your means or as comfortable as possible, as long as your immediate rights haven't been stripped from you or from a person or persons that you care about, no heavy lifting is going to be done. Complaining is going to be happening. But if it's not directly going to affect you or touch you, the attitude becomes that someone else is going to fix this.
I have a couple of closing questions. What is your hope for the future of the LGBTQ plus community in Lafayette, in Louisiana, you know, nationally, etc.?
I hope that at large, it just at every level, Lafayette, statewide, cities, Louisiana itself, and the world, that it just becomes, it continues to be more open and more of a home and more of a safe space for everyone. And not just the few that are in these micro groups. That it actually becomes a community. And that we continue to support each other no matter how different we are, because we are very different. I feel like when every LGBTQ person or queer person comes out, there is this hope for better. And that comes along with a feeling of a freshness and newness. And I hope that when people come out, that they have that feeling and they can continue to carry on that, or that the community continues to make people feel that way.
What do you think is the biggest misconception about the LGBTQ plus community?
That it is super welcoming and embracing of differences, because it's sometimes harder, it's sometimes more intolerant of the world at large. We have so much greatness about us, but I think that there's also very, very deep-rooted self-hate within us that does not go away, and so much ingrained within us that we think that the words "I'm gay" or "I'm queer" will erase, and it doesn't. And people have to one, be willing to admit that, and be willing to do the work to dismantle those things. And none of that is easy. You know, I said a mouthful about being black and gay, and what I did not say and what I do want to express is that I have not always been the easiest person to deal with, because I am direct and I am self-assured, and when I feel attacked, I go for major arteries. And so that is the way that I was brought up to learn how to defend myself. From a family who acted that way in confrontation. So I had to learn through therapy, through talks, through doing the work, that there's different ways to communicate with people. And when I did finally start doing that work, and when I did finally start to be open to more communication and listening to my faults and listening to where I could improve, that's the only reason that I could sit here today and positively and super assertively say those things about the community, is because even when I changed tune, the community didn't.
Is there anything that we haven't covered that you would like to include?
I just am grateful for this interview, for this type of project. I see it going farther than it's even been imagined. And just leaving behind a legacy is super important, and I'm glad to have been included in this. Because this also, even like I'm telling you, you know, I had to learn how to be a better version of myself. Some of these things that I've talked about, I've never talked about with another person. I've never talked about with my therapist, and we talk about everything. So this is, it's important to get this out, and to look at the parts of ourselves that we sometimes don't want to address, because that's how we get better. Yeah.
On that note, I'm greatly appreciative that you've been here with us today, and yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you.